Welcome to the Speakin' Podcast. You can find all our episodes on speakinpodcast.com. We're also on BitChute and YouTube. You'll find the links in the podcast description. I'm also a podcasting coach because I've got four other podcasts, and you find everything on bio.link/podcaster. My guest today, based in Finland, it's Dr. Markku Vilnius. He's the chair of UNESCO in Learning Society and Futures of Education, a renowned futurist, award-winning author, speaker and professor at Finland Future Research Center. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for the kind invitation, Roy. It's a pleasure.
So, I mean, like, you've done some amazing speaking around the world, and I've seen that you're like, you've done 150 radio and TV appearances. So you might kind of talk first about your speaking journey, but going back, from an early age, like how you got comfortable speaking.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a bit of an issue. Actually, I remember when I was a teenager in those days, I was actually quite timid. I wasn't any kind of a public speaker in those days. And when I got to the phase when I started to my career as a researcher, I saw that in the seminars and conferences, I wanted to say something, but soon I got up and I wanted to say, I had forgotten what I had to say. And that, but then that the learning was that, well, I have to do more of that. I have to learn myself to be ease with myself. Because the problem, the challenge often is is that you are kind of too much focused on yourself and what is it that you need to be speaking and all that. And in that moment, the whole kind of idea disappears. And that, so with certain training on myself, I started to be at ease. And when you are at ease, then your ideas flow easier, as we all know. It's like a tennis playing. You play the best when you are at ease, but still you are very sort of a dynamic. And actually the dynamics for your presentations also comes from the fact that you let the kind of a natural rhythm gets into you, so you can pronounce things more clearly. You are not just a talking machine, but you are more giving a kind of a oscillation dynamics of the speeches. So this is the way that I started to work then later on my research career, but also, of course, increasingly on my consultancy career.
And as a professor then, like, I suppose because students are probably one of the hardest audience to connect with them and keep them entertained, did you learn a lot, or is there anything that you could kind of tell people what you've learned from that to help them engage with kind of the audience?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. They are not necessarily the easiest audience. And the way I have perhaps learned to do this is that I try to be very sensitive who my audience is. And actually, there is a story behind this. Back in the day when I was still working on my doctoral thesis, I went to this international seminar. There was this very distinguished Pakistan professor speaking on us. And I started to listen in, not only because of he was brilliant with his content, but the kind of the form. And I could see how closely and intimately he was following his audience. And I could see that actually he took, even if that was something intangible, he took some of that stuff and he sort of shifted sometimes his way of talking because of the response that he was getting. And I thought that this was something extraordinary. I went afterwards to ask, how did you do that? And he said, well, Markku, I come from Pakistan, from a small village, but we had a very vivid oral culture there. So we learned as we were growing how not only to speak, but also how to listen, because that was as important to learn how to listen. So he said that he sort of deployed that in his later career, and he found out that these kind of speaking engagements came so much better after he was not just kind of a talking head, as many of the academics are, by the way, but you're not just a kind of a, yeah, letting yourself go and talk, but you always remember that there is an audience, and some of that learning I have been trying to do with my students or with my audience wherever I go.
Brilliant. And with all the radio then, because I think that's a skill set in itself. I know I've had a few times that, and I just panicked when I went on radio, and then I joined Clubhouse, which was just audio only, and I was panicking, but I got over it. But like, what kind of tips and things did you learn through your journey of being on radio?
Yeah, as you said, radio is another a media that that requires a little bit of its own way of thinking. The first thing is that you need to be more articulate. So it's like if you start to swallow too much of your words, you start to be very boring in a way, because most of the people actually that are probably listening also this podcast is are non-English by their native language. So you need to be able to kind of try to find the fine tune to the same kind of a frequency. And that also means that you need to be articulate, not talking too fast. I know you Irish usually talk quite fast, but at least as a non-Irish, and Finns are known to be quite slow sometimes. So it falls naturally on me. But even before that, when I started to do my first TV programs, and I was running some shows in the TV, I also learned then to be more kind of a prompt with not having too long sentences. That's also something that academics love to do, a long sentences, because there are always these ifs and buts, and it takes a lot of this go around. So then I sort of I try to cut my sentences sort of short. And to some extent, that also holds true for the radio. But really, the most important being to be kind of articulate, and hopefully, not talking too long at the time.
And like, as you mentioned, the Irish speak fast, and it's something that I became conscious of after getting some feedback, because if I'm speaking to a fellow Irishman or an English, sometimes you just engage in the conversation so fast, yeah, and you forget it's about the listeners. And now, even not so long ago, I had a guy, and I intentionally made sure that I wasn't engaging in a typical Irish conversation.
Right. Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah. Irish conversation can be really very lively. I have a lot of experience of Ireland, beautiful people and good conversations around Guinness or otherwise. But it is also a very kind of lively oral culture that always been a part of the Irish culture very much.
Yeah, and because I was looking at your CV, and because it's on your website, and I mean, mm-hmm, we could talk. If I was to read through your CV, we would be like the hour on it. It's extremely impressive. But you got an Emerald Literary National, the most outstanding article of the year. You've got a few other ones as well.
I mean, over the years, I've been working on this future stuff now for almost 30 years, so quite a lot has happened throughout my career. And what is particularly with this field, kind of academic discipline as future studies, and moving into more kind of a applying consultancy and speaking and so forth, is that it's still very new area. It's still something that is not very well established, like sociology or economics or anything. So when I started to work on that, it actually started to emerge as a sort of a serious scientific discipline, while also a kind of a useful set of tools and methods for companies. I mean, strategic thinking itself is not so long that it has been happening in the companies in a more systematic way. But also things like a scenario building and what are the techniques for building scenarios. The first one came in the 1970s and 80s, and still I would say the most of the companies in the world do not know how to make use of those tools, even if we are living now at the time when you really need those, because there is not just one future which is clearly ahead of us. There are many alternatives that can happen.
And the seven principles thing, because there was one of the videos that I was looking at and you were kind of touching, because I think it's very relevant now, because now there's a lot of kind of, you know, if people are looking at corporations and they think that they, you know, they don't really care for humanity and everything, and the different points that you were touching. So if you wouldn't mind, we go through them, because I thought it was fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Why not? I think if I try to go rather swiftly, the first is simple as this: look to the future. But the idea is that not, because looking to the future and not looking too much at the past, we have always tendency to look at the past, because that past is what we have a data. So we love to look at the past and then maybe make some projection on the based on the data. But future is always different. And while it's good to know something of your past, I'm not saying that forget the past, it's not my message, but focus on future, be that the focus, because that's different. That's the principle, because so many companies and organizations are very much past-ridden and past-driven, sorry. And that really means that they usually misses the point when something is really changing, because they let the past drive them to the future. Then the second is that anticipate future needs. So what does this mean? We need that the needs also in the society, they are not something permanent only. I mean, we have our basic needs, yes, that we need. We need the, you know, clothing. We need the house. We need the food on the table. Those are the basic needs. But on the top of that, there are lots of other needs that are historically moving, because we see new opportunities, new possibilities. But the needs, what I mean by this is that the needs are sort of a changing in the top of the hierarchy as well. We need to do now something about the climate change. We need to do something about the inequality in the country, which is in the most of the country, which is rising. And those type of the future needs, they sort of, yes, they are built from the past, but they are unique in their history, so that now it's the time to do something about it. And that is what we need to be very careful and very sensitive. What are those future needs that we need to observe? We need to acknowledge them, and then they turn from, let's say, from the risk into the opportunities for us.
And just on that, actually, with the companies, because I would say, like, maybe Kodak would be one of them that didn't look into the future. They were looking at the past, because apparently that there was somebody that was working there came up with the digital, that the digital was the future, and they didn't want to do it. So he went to Sony, and, you know, I think I was at 2012 that it went bankrupt for a company that was actually the biggest in this industry for, you know, it's.
Yeah, and that's exactly the top example of what happens when you are too much past driven. Unfortunately, I have to say the same thing about my Nokia as a phone company. That
went too my long. First phone was a Nokia, and it's like it was shocking to actually see it.
And actually, you know, long before Apple came up with their first model with the touch phone, they had that on their laboratory 4 or 5 years before. But according to their market research, people didn't find it fancy. And this is the problem that you often, you probably, some of you remember Steve Jobs, they're always saying that never ask anything from consumers because they just see what they have that is in front of them. And so you need to be the one that reaches out in the future and offers something that they cannot anticipate, they cannot think about. And that is also something that needs to be kept in the mind so that if you start to become a too much comfort with your past, also a lot of the good companies does that they stick to because they think that they are so good in what they do and they say continue to do. And then the world kind of goes by. This was exactly what happened with Nokia. And that was a very unfortunate, but that's the story. And Kodak has exactly the same, too much stuck in the past. Now, the next principle, the third principle I want to introduce is to use the incomplete knowledge, because when we go to the future, the realm of the future, and we still have this idea that we need to be certain before we make this move, we need to be certain we make this investment, we need to have numbers all around there, and we need to be certain about these numbers. We need to accept the fact that always any information from and about future is always incomplete. So we have to deal with what we have and accept then that is the amount of the knowledge that we can get from the future and then decide whether that is good enough or not, but not looking for the certainty, because then that is usually the stuff that also make us laggards. We are moving then when everybody else is moving. When taxi drivers are talking about it, it's too late, you know, then you are a laggard. But often companies tend to do that, particularly if they think that they are very good in what they are doing. They can see the new stuff coming, and there is always a new stuff coming, and we need to be a kind of aware of that. So that's about the that principle. Then the next principle is expect the unexpected. So particularly in our times, when we have seen how much complexity there is in the world, and the complexity has risen mainly because there is a 70 years of huge amount of globalization, connectivity, and all that has kind of pushed this exponential growth worldwide, and that has created a very different kind of the world. And with this type of the world, we need to be waiting for more surprises than in previous. Maybe in the previous times, there still were surprises, certainly, but now there are more surprises, because this is the principle that derives from. Well, the more complex the system is, the more interaction and the more surprises you get, and this is just a kind of an equation that always works. So, how to deal with this thing about that there is always unexpected events? The real issue is that, well, you need to build your own resiliency. You need to be able to act whatever new comes in, and you still need to act and not kind of be in the situation where you cannot act. And that means that you need to be always looking at the chart around you, the environment around you, that this is interesting. What's the meaning of this phenomenon? What is the meaning? I mean, now we're talking about the artificial intelligence and blockchain, and it's becoming almost kind of an everyday talk. But long before that, we were already need to ask ourselves if we are in any way kind of in the domain of technology, particularly. So what is the significance for us? What is our take into those? So those type of the questions we always need to be asking, because always something unexpected is going to happen, which we found out in the case of the pandemic so well. I mean, there were some warning signals there, yes, and there was Bill Gates saying that a couple of years earlier, yes, but some faint signal something was happening with its other big event. I mean, Russian attack in Ukraine, we saw also quite some signs there before. Of course, we didn't want to believe that this is going to happen, yet it happened. And that is also something of the shocking when we this wishing things to go in a certain direction, but the reality talks otherwise. That is also quite often what we need to be dealing. So the kind of a summarizing is that we need to have a different scenarios about the future. And then we will look at, okay, this is probably more probable, but this is less probable, that might still happen. And we kind of exercise ourselves more into this type, the more ready we are when this unexpected comes to our doorstep and we are ready to act and not kind of stay stiff and asking ourselves, what are we going to do now?
And there's also opportunities when things happen, because for those that actually, you know, stay still, that you can actually buy your competitor who just panics when something happens, like in the last few years.
Yeah. As Chinese know well, because I think in their writing, this crisis and the opportunity is very close to each other. So in the crisis, there is always an opportunity. And of course, that's something that we need to understand as well. Then there is, I guess it's now fifth principle. It's a principle is that think long term and short term. So meaning that there needs to be a balance between the long term and short term. And usually when I go to talk to the boards and of the corporations, at some point this question that, okay, how much time you are actually spending with the long term, with the more strategic issues. And quite often these boards kind of have to admit that most of the time they are just dealing with the short term issues. Always this new kind of
firefighting mode.
Firefighting mode, yes, particularly in the last 2 years, certainly so much. But we need to retain our capacity to talk long-term as well. And it needs to be balanced. And if we don't do that, then we become a very much like opportunist, which might work for some time, but at some point in time, we're going to lose the game. That's pretty obvious. You cannot be kind of opportunistic all the time and for longer periods of time. Because you're going to fall into your own sort of a trap. So you need to have a strategic view. And so you need to balance these two, short-term and long-term. I wouldn't say that either of them are more important. All I'm saying is that it needs to be balanced. Both needs to be treated well when you are on the top level of any company or organization. And then comes something which I call dream productively. So dreaming and imagination is the kind of our inherent qualities as human beings. It's probably the most important asset that we have, and that really differentiates us from other species. This imagining the futures, this building images about the futures, we can do it in a very conscious way, because usually we do it a bit kind of unconscious. We just hold the images. We hold what the Jung called archetypes, kind of a patterns of thoughts and consequently behavior. But if we start to create images, they can be very powerful. When we do that on the conscious basis. But that is not enough. So this productively means that not only dreaming is enough, but you need to let also your imagination talk to you as to how to move forward. And people who are using that on a constant basis understand that actually quite often something called intuition, which to me means a kind of intuition is that kind of a part in our system that kind of filters and receives a lot of information from different corners and kind of puts them together. and suggest something, and we need to be listening to that intuition, in addition to our thought processes, in addition to what we observe and what are the facts and so forth. We need to use that very much. So that this dreaming that we're doing, that it is not just stays on the level of a daydreaming, but it really becomes a part of our focus.
And so with that, actually, because I heard that like Google, they allow like one day of the week for kind of creativity. Is there many companies that's actually starting to do that, or is it just?
I think Google has been really pioneer on this, because they simply saw that it adds up to the productivity and really the creativity of the company. That was, I think, one of the ultimate things. And I've seen also some of my research on this, how companies are doing that, allows this very much to happen. Yes, that they kind of encourages people to take off and be kind of offsite and take time for this kind of dreaming productively and imagining things. And because otherwise we're sort of killing that part of the brain quite easily, and we are kind of only, you know, using our sort of more of a rational mind, and that associative creative mind, we leave that on the back. And of course, then we are not using properly our full potential, and that's a pity. So we need to be, and I see that the company slowly but surely are moving towards that direction, certainly that they allow and they see the significance of not having this kind of an old type of the sausage factory where you just go and do your thing and do your 8 or 9 hours, whatever, and then you go home and you change your hat. And they want people to be in their work as a full human being, just not like operators or kind of more like a robot, like people, but use their full capacity, because that's also what makes the most satisfaction for the people who are employed. They definitely feel, in our times, particularly the upcoming generation, they feel that they are not only entitled to that, but they really need that type of the space to feel themselves that they are really human beings.
And with because the Finnish system is one of the best in the world for the education system, because there's not as many hours, they're very creative, whereas in the America and most of Ireland and England, it's more kind of, they've removed arts, they've removed a lot of the creativity subjects, music and stuff like that, and it's kind of just educating people to be compliant and just be a worker, like what you said, with the hat taken off, just going into production line kind of system.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. A Finnish education system is actually very famous for that, that we don't have too much homework to do, because the principle goes that you need to have another type of the life as well. And also that our school start relatively late. At 7 years old, we go to our first class, which is quite.
I was quite four old in Ireland.
Yeah, yeah, that's a kind of a Victorian order, I guess. So, but I think some of the really interesting findings took place in the Finnish education system when we started to kind of realize that, well, this is the great way, actually, how we can build up a more egalitarian culture, because part of that is that, well, we practically have no any private schools, or if we have private schools, they are not with a huge fees or anything. They are just they're just normal schools. And I myself went through this special school called Steiner School or Waldorfschule in Germany. And that is particularly the type of the school that allows a lot of creativity and arts and music and all that to be a part of the tuition and the curriculum program. And I don't regret that. to be honest. I really enjoy that throughout my school time. And but it's also this what the whole Finnish system, education system, particularly, well, the primary education system really embraces and being a part of the success story, really.
Why do you think that other countries don't replicate? Like my youngest child, he's nine. They're doing that. They're copying the Finnish system for the school that he's in, but it's not replicated around. I mean, there's little drops in every country, I presume. But why don't they just, like, when they've realized how successful it is, why aren't they copying it?
I think the only answer is that they are kind of they don't know how to do this, so they sort of they stay with the old system that is comfortable and easy, even if it doesn't produce great results. I think maybe, you know, it might be that some of that is also a bit of a cultural thing, so that the way we grow in our society and the way the what is top of the spirit, you know, very little corruption, very equal and all that. So I think that spirit is also exemplified in the, but if you have a very different kind of a society and you want to take this one thing of, you know, education system, yeah, there might be some issues and problems that I have heard over the time, because this whole fuss started in the early 2000 about the Finnish education system when we got this PISA results and Finland was, you know, on the top of that. And I remember started to go around and explaining what this Finnish education system is and why it is so relatively big and so good. I'm not saying it's perfect or anything, but it's good. And it turned out to me that it's actually very much the question of how do we see as a human being. It's a very fundamental issue, which is actually in the back. It's kind of a, what is our idea of a human being, which is in the back. We always need to ask that question when we think about the education system. So what is it? What is it for? What do we want to educate for? What is our idea? Who are these human beings that we want to educate? And that is the only way when we get sort of a deep enough to understand also how we need to change our current sort of education practices and cultures, which unfortunately, in so many countries, really stem from the very old times, and with a very different idea of what the education was for. So I think there is a great need around the world to change our education system to be more kind of a human friendly and really embrace the human being as a whole, and not just a kind of a like a bit like a machine that need to be taught this and that, and you know, you just listen to your teacher and you try to digest everything, and then you are a good person and helpful for your society. But that's a very, very old-fashioned way of look at the education system.
And with like the corporations then, because like with the consumerism, I mean, if you look back, say in the 70s when stuff was being built, it was built to last. Whereas now it's kind of be built to, make it last for a year or 2 years, then you buy it again. And I know that there's been a lot of like the corporations for the light bulb and stuff like that, where they do an agreement with each other so that they last for so many hours. And like, can we get out of that? Because like, there's a lot of problems. There's a lot of the seas are destroyed with all the plastics and everything. But it's really down to consumerism, and like a company's business is to make as much profit as possible. So I understand it from their side, but the reality is, like, you mentioned about us being human. If you actually look back and look deep within, can that be changed, or are we too deep in that, we can't go back from the way it is?
I think the real problem is that we are too much into consumerism and materialism in our time, and there's been kind of a 200 years, I would say, the deep dive into that, which I think in the beginning was sort of unnecessary. So this was all about how to create the material conditions to live a decent life. That's the industrialization and modernization has been all about. But now we have to sort of change that, that cannot be the purpose. As much as there's kind of be a purpose for the corporation, that, you know, to just to create value for the shareholders, and that's it. If you forget all the other parts, all the other stakeholders, you forget the society, you forget the clients, you forget your employees and so forth, then you're creating a big mess, essentially, and not such a good business in the long run. So the business leaders all around the world has to acknowledge that, you know, this kind of a more of a stakeholder view. And that is also necessarily more long-term views, so that if you think about that, there needs to be also other ways that you can you are contributing to society besides providing places for people to work, so that you come up with something that helps the society become better. So that is the challenge of every corporate these days. Not so in the 20, 30 years, but when I look at, you know, some of the pioneering companies. I did myself some quite a lot of research on Patagonia, the outdoor kind of a global brand as an outdoor company with, you know, gadgets and outwears and all that, and they started to turn on this kind of a more sustainability mode already back in the 1970s. In fact, with the founder, who was a kind of a nature enthusiast, realized that he want to build a better gadget for his mountaineering and go into the wilderness, but he couldn't find anyone, so he decided to make a company himself, and now it's a global company. But what they did was that they all the time they kept in their mind that, well, do as little as possible harm for the environment while you are producing all this stuff, and while you are delivering to the consumers. So that has led a quite a pioneering innovations. For instance, they were the first ones when you can, you know, if you wear their jacket and you get tired of the jacket, or the jacket is not perfectly anymore fitting, or zipper is not working anymore, you can bring it back to the store, and they will repair it. And you get a bit of a money for that, and they put it back on the sale, and so many of these type of other examples, which actually has built a very unique loyalty for this company. But what I mean by this example is that once you see that your company is a bit on the larger missions, then rather than just putting the pockets money to the owner's pockets, then that is the moment when you also get inspired by something further that helps the company to be more long-term. Because in fact, if you want to keep your company alive for, let's say, 200 years, you need to be able to shift fast when it's needed, shift to do things in the better way. You cannot get be stuck on your laurels. You need to be moving, and you need to be sensitive to the demands that comes from the environment or the new opportunities that are there, but do it in the more kind of a, with a kind of a, this strategic a view in your mind, not just because there is a short-term opportunities here and there. And since our world is getting to the stage where we need a dramatic shift in ways that we are dealing with the nature, quite often this inspiration will come from building things to be more sustainable, more long-term, more enduring, and more friendly to nature. And others may go to help to do something with the inequality by providing a good quality stuff for the decent prices, for instance. So there are different methods and different kind of strategies how to deal with that at all the companies in the world, I believe, in the future that are sustaining and successful need to kind of do their pick, need to choose that strategic intent which goes beyond the success of their business.
And like when you look at, say, the likes of Walmart or some of the bigger companies, and you hear that, you know, their staff are on food stamps, and yet the founder's son are, you know, billionaires and things like that. I think there has to be a kind of a percentage that goes into the staff that's working on it as well, because like a company like Walmart shouldn't have people on food stamps.
Oh yeah, that's terrible. That just shows something, a total lack of understanding. I think it was I was just I'm just currently reading the new biography of Edison. And of course he was probably the greatest inventor of all time, along with Tesla. But in somewhere there, he also says something about the Henry Ford. And Henry Ford established this kind of first factories and started to build this kind of an empire. He early on realized that he has to pay much better than the average paid workers, because then they are much more engaged and they do better work and they are more productive in every sense. So he understood that, keeping on this kind of minimum wage doesn't help to create any kind of a commitment and engagement. And that what he found then, 100 years ago, is still pretty much true. You need to take very good care of your employees, and there are good numbers of ways you can make them a part of the owners in the different systems, and you need to show them appreciation particularly. And so there needs to be kind of an empathy inside the company, but of course extending to the customers as well. And that is something where we also start to see that a lot of those winning companies take this seriously. And because there is a huge fight now, and the battle over the best employees, sorry. So particularly in the digital front, so that there is a lot of demand out there. So the way that you can keep and retain your workers, particularly if they are on the top, is that you need to think very carefully how you engage them in a positive way. And in such a way that they see that, well, this is not just a company that I'm working for, it's actually my company. And when you get that level of engagement, then you can be pretty sure that they can sustain the hard times, and then they can also make a commitment for the long term in the company.
And you mentioned it, Nikola Tesla. Like, I mean, all his patents were kind of, you know, taken, and we don't know about the technology that, but it seemed like that they had an energy source that was. But if you look at like what, like the wind turbines and the solar, like I was shocked to find out that they can't recycle the wind turbines, and they were dumping them in landfills. Massive. I mean, these are huge things. And the solars as well. I know there's one company in Poland that started to do it that you can recycle it, but there you can't recycle them either. And that's kind of shocking to see something like that we're kind of pushing to be the alternative better, and it's not.
There is still a very long way to the what can we call the circular economy. According to the different calculation, there is still only 9% that gets of the materials that we are using in our economies that get circulated, which is astounding number actually. It's sort of a devastating that shows the level in which our so-called civilization is at the point. So we still don't know how to do that, but we need the good cases and good practices and the pioneers who are doing that, and certainly just producing renewable energy technologies doesn't make you a saint. You need to be also thinking about those things, that how these materials get recycled, and what is the how they can be done. And since we have been putting this far, not too much investment and effort to deal with these questions, it's still pretty much on the early stage. But I think world is now speaking to us in the ways that say that, well, come on, guys, you know, you need to ramp up all this performance and see everything in the economy, in the society need to be circular. And only then we can kind of hope that we get any kind of a sustainability track.
Well, I think the beauty is that everyone now is conscious of it. And there's a lot more that actually want, you know, that we're not using all the wastage that's going on. I mean, I'm seeing in supermarkets, particularly in America, because there's over 50% of my audience is from America. But like they'd have an orange in a plastic container with the orange skin gone or things like that. And like, you know, we have to kind of remove stupidity, like, because there's a lot of that going on.
Exactly, yes. We need to be becoming much more conscious. And this is really this awareness of this foolishness about how much we are wasting our resources, squandering our resources. That is exactly what has to become to an end. Because this far, our economy and the whole kind of a growth principles that, you know, GDP growth and companies growth, we have not really recognized these things, that how do we do this growth? And that's from the larger point of view, particularly from the nature point of view, but also from our humanity's future point of view, that is what counts. That is what defines whether this growth is good or bad. And we are just sort of taking those first steps. That's why I'm saying, in my grand scheme of things, when I look at this long-term socio-economic waves, where I see that there are always these 40 to 60 year old waves, and now we are on the sixth wave. If we start from the counting from the industry, from the beginning of industrialization, this sixth wave would started 2010 roughly and extended to 2050. That's going to be the time of the resource efficiency. It's all about that. And even the new technologies, AI, blockchain, all that, it's also there primarily to ramp up this resource efficiency, to make the end of this terrible squandering of natural resources that we have done this far, and which we need to stop, because the limits are there. I am part of the Club of Rome, that was the first organization back in the 1970s to come up and say, hey guys, we have a problem here. What is the problem? The problem is that there are limits to growth. So this report that came, that was done by MIT on those days, they were the first ones that we were able to model the global stock and flows. And they came up with the conclusion that if we are continuing this path, somewhere between the 50 and 100 years, we're going to end up a real problem. And now it's about 50 years, and we can see how our weather patterns are changing, how much more we have extreme droughts, all kinds of oscillations in the weather. We can see that if you go now to the Eastern Asia, you don't find fish anymore because there's a fish stock is almost empty. The 70% of the world fisheries are almost gone, and so forth and so forth. Deforestation, all that. So everywhere is happening the same, that we are coming very close to the point that something really dramatically needs to be done. And the point is that while we have the knowledge, we don't necessarily have the consciousness, and the consciousness needs to be there to make us really act. But I'm sure that we are crossing over that threshold right now, and the future will be looking very different.
Like with the fishing, I mean, I've heard this, the super trawlers are doing major damage with that, because they scoop the whole, you know, the seabed and everything and just destroy everything. And like a lot of the plastic, apparently, like, you know, they're trying to get stop people using straws, which is fair enough. But it's like over 50% is actually from the netting that's used in the fishing. So like it's things like that that they need to be looking at that makes a massive difference, instead of looking at the little things. And I, because I had a food truck and I was trying to do everything right with with the fish, and it was like the MSC, you know, that it's replenished. And it turns out that's a fraud, that that whole system is actually made up. They just pretend it, and they're just charging people to have that stamp on it. And like, we need, like, I think the frustration in the world is we need accountability for things like that. And when people see that you don't get away with that, then faith will return in humanity and more people will be doing better. But when they're seeing people doing, I mean, everyone is kind of conscious of a lot of the craziness going on at the moment, but there's no accountability. And if we can get accountability, then there'll be a lot more change faster, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And a very good point. And that actually leads to my last principle, which is that respect the knowledge, respect the knowledge that we have, because sometimes we are not acknowledging the information that we have that should us kind of give us the food not only for thought but for the action, and we find a thousand different reasons why we are not acting on the knowledge that we have. And most of the people in their individual life, but also organizations and countries do the same, are not doing what they could do because they are not acting on the knowledge that they have. And that is something what needs kind of ask us to more often to realize where we are and to kind of stop for a moment and say, what do we actually know about this? And not just the running further, and you know, and not kind of stop and realize actually we know much more. I like this fishery thing; it's been long known. I mean that there is this problem, and still we sort of continue the same practices, and that is something that we should, as human beings, be very aware of. That, you know, if we get those same bad experience time after time, we should stop and do something else. Okay, easily said and done, but this is exactly the challenge that we have. So we need to respect the knowledge that we have and take from there as well. I mean, which doesn't mean that we need a new knowledge. We do need a new knowledge, but we also need to use the knowledge that we have.
Excellent. Listen, Marco, thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. And just because I want you to give the different websites and everything, but I always like to ask somebody about the social media, because I know you're on TikTok, you've a very good, very popular YouTube channel as well. But what's your go-to on social media? What do you think serves you best?
Well, this social media project that I now have over the year, I became very active. And that has given me a terrific amount of joy, to be honest. Of course, some work as well, but it is really nice, because that, to me, I've always been kind of a mostly, when I have my audiences, they are on a certain, you know, geographies and certain places, so forth. But this social media gives me a really opportunity to talk to people all around the world, and the response I get is quite fascinating and really, really sort of keeps me going. So you can find me just writing my name, Marco Villenius, YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, all of those channels. I'm very active also in LinkedIn, and so so that's the best way, because you always find me there under my name. I have pretty unique name. I think there is no other Marco Villenius even in Finland, so you cannot miss me for someone else.
Okay, perfect. Listen, thank you very much. I'll make sure I'll put the links both on the audio and the video of all the ones you just mentioned.
Oh, thank you okay. Very much for it.
So that's all for the Speaking Podcast. You'll find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. As mentioned, we're on BitChute and YouTube, and you'll find my podcast coaching along with my other four podcasts on bio.link/podcaster. Be sure to give us a thumbs up, 5-star rating, share with your friends. Until next week, take care.